Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday. No, it's Wednesday already, November 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the program, we help you solve your computer and technology problems. Whether you're having issues with a firewall, maybe you can't connect to the internet, we have an expert in the studio to help you troubleshoot. Tony Yang is operator of Albany-based Gig Computers, and he's learned something today. Don't come in the studio too early because you have to listen to me complain about computers for several minutes before the show starts, so I'm sure he'll sit in the green room next time he's on. But he's here now. If you have a computer or technology question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. Computers, we're stuck with them. Might as well talk about it after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here to answer your computer and technology questions is our friend Tony Yang. Tony began Gig Computers in 1996 while studying computer science at SUNY Albany. His company began as a hobby in college, and it just grew into one of the largest PC retailers in the region. He's like Bill Gates, only on a smaller scale. Tony manages networks for numerous companies and organizations, including WAMC, ranging from a few computers to hundreds. If you have a computer question, give this guy a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mr. Tony Yang, how are you, buddy?
I'm great, Ray. Glad to be back in the studio with you.
It's nice to have you back here. And you know, the Windows 11 is coming, and there's already angst out there.
Why? Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
So Windows 11 is pretty picky. You know, in the past, you could have almost any computer be able to upgrade from 7 to 8 to 10. 11 has some really strict standards.
You mean RAM and processor and things like that?
RAM, not so much of an issue. You got to have, I think it's 4 gigs.
You really should
have 8 or more.
Yeah.
But the CPU type, you got to have the TPM. You got to have secure boot. There's a whole program that actually runs and checks all these different components to make sure it's compatible with Windows 11. I can tell you that for me personally, my laptop won't upgrade.
Yeah.
My desktop at home, two of them, will not upgrade. So I'm thinking it's got to be affecting a ton of people out there.
Is it worth it, though?
It's a pretty nice system.
Yeah.
There hasn't been any reports of, you know, the problems that we had back in Windows 8. You remember those days?
Oh, yes, I do.
And the thing that, for me personally, the exciting thing is the Android support. You can run Android apps right inside Windows 11.
Yeah.
That's a great feature. Other than that, you know, we haven't began any of the upgrades at our client sites.
Right.
We typically wait for a little bit and see what happens. But we haven't heard too many negative reports on Windows 11.
You guys are very conservative about that. You do the systems here. And I mean, we only got off of Windows 98 a couple of weeks ago. So
don't let that word spread out there.
No, I'm kidding, of course. But you do take your time. And I am the same way. I think Windows 10 has been really, really good.
Windows 10 is one of the best that we can remember for a long, long time. 7 was pretty good, but it took a couple of service packs to get it to where it needed to be. Windows 10 just came out rock solid.
All right, these emails came in, and this is from Anonymous somewhere. I picked up a laptop at a garage sale. Didn't have a password to open it. Can I revert it to factory settings and open it for use just to store and edit photo files?
So the quick answer to that is yes.
Okay.
There's actually programs out there that will reset the administrator password.
Just everything.
To the entire system. Once you have the admin password, you can log in and do it.
Well, you don't
have to
wipe the whole machine?
You do not. We have tools, so people will bring in their laptops with Windows 10 or 7 on it, and then we run a program, and it will reset the admin password. So you can do it. For most home users, if you don't have that type of program, reinstalling it would be the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and if this person who presumably picked up this old laptop, which is probably not state-of-the-art technology, if they want to put an operating system on it, there are free ones that you can get. Right now, I'm not really familiar with some of these that aren't Microsoft or aren't Mac, but there are operating systems you can get, right, that are not Microsoft-based or
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can download Android and put it on a regular PC. I don't know if you've been seeing these ads on TV, you know, like late at night. I'm up late at night a lot.
Yeah, me too.
So there are these advertisements about how to get your old computer to run much, much faster.
Yeah.
And it comes on a USB thumbstick.
And it scares me that, frankly, because what do they got on the USB?
Right. So what that is, it's an Android OS running in there. This is why these Chromebooks are so inexpensive, because it doesn't take a whole lot. You can run a very, very slow Atom processor in it, and it still runs pretty quick because it's more like a phone than an actual laptop. So you run this whole thing on a USB thumb drive on a very old computer, and it's got amazing speed.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can't do everything with it. I mean,
that's right.
One of my daughters has a for a couple of years now has had one of these Chromebooks or whatever you call it. It still is lightning quick, but there are certain things that you just can't do that I like to do on my desktop computer.
That's right. I mean, you can't run Microsoft Office applications as an example.
Right.
There's no external storage.
That's a biggie.
You know. So for users who want to use Office, you can get a subscription to Office 365 and use the online version.
Uh-huh.
That works pretty much the same way, and you will store all of your data on Microsoft OneDrive. So there are ways around it, but it's inconvenient.
Yeah, I think you're right. Tony Yang joins us today. It's Computers on the Show. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get to your phone calls in a moment. One more email here for now, and this one's from Julie. Julie writes, when should I consider replacing my laptop? I have a 2014 high-end MSI gaming laptop that I use constantly. It still works well, but it's showing physical wear. I'm wondering if you have an opinion as to when I should start planning to replace it. I don't have any storage problems at the moment. And that's from Julie.
Great question, Julie. So we, if you look at our clientele, we generally make a recommendation to replace their workstations anywhere between 3 years to five. Now, 3 is an aggressive schedule.
Yeah, very much so.
But if you look at most state agencies, they're on that schedule.
That's because we're paying for it, all right?
So 5 years, I think, is a good good amount of time to run a PC, especially if you're running it 24/7.
Yeah.
I say, you know, going on 7-8 years, then you're pushing it. So a 2014 laptop or computer, it's time to think about upgrading it. I can tell you that you're not likely going to be able to upgrade that to Windows 10.
Ah, okay.
So if you're planning on going that route, it's time to get it replaced.
I mean, to me, Julie's computer is 7 years. I bought a new desktop, a tower, 3 or 4 years ago. To me, that seems like yesterday. I'm very old, but it seems like I should get a few more years out of it than three.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, my desktop is a Dell PowerEdge, I think T20, which is a semi-server type of machine. I only got that thing just a few years ago, and I cannot upgrade to Windows 11 on that machine. So, you know, the technology is moving so fast.
Tony Yang is here. You have 3 desktop computers at your house?
More
what does your wife say about that?
She doesn't like to see the electric bill, that's for sure.
I got you there. All right, let's grab a phone call before the first break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Sarah's in Sheffield. Sarah, you're on.
Hello. How you doing?
Hi, good.
I'm a daily money manager, so I'm driving around helping all my clients, mostly seniors, and I invariably wind up working on IT issues, and I continually confront this printer offline. And so I travel with a cable so I can cable it, and still I get the printer offline message all the time. What can I do?
That is, I experience that problem myself sometimes at home. Most of the time, it's because there's some type of a communications error between the printer and the computer. Most often, it's because the printers, by default, would put itself into what's called a sleep mode. So it literally, it basically powers down.
Yeah.
so that it doesn't use any energy at all. And when it does that, it stops communicating with your desktop, and that causes lots of the printer offline activities. The way to do that is to disable most software. Most printers will have a menu in there to allow you to disable the sleep mode, and that should help.
Leave it on all the time.
Leave it on all the time, and that's the downside. It's going to use electricity while it's not being used.
Yeah.
But that's a small price to pay sometimes to not have to deal with the frustration.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Part of my routine is to turn it off and turn it back on. Does that help wake it up?
It does. Most of the time, that should help. The other thing that you might want to do on top of that, Sarah, is to go into the Windows services and restart the print spooler. That would definitely get it going, because what that does is it shuts off all the software that runs your printers, and then restart them from ground zero. Essentially, it's the same as rebooting your entire computer and getting the printer drivers to run again. That most of the time will solve the problem.
Yeah, I've wondered about this spooler service thing it does when you run the tools. Okay.
Yeah. There you go. Well, thank you for the call. We'll take a break here. Oh, yes, the print spooler. We've had that conversation. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tony Yang is here, computers, and we'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, computers and tech today with Tony Yang of Gig Computers. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll get back to the email box in a little while. But Dave in Woodstock, go ahead.
Yes, it's me.
Yeah, that's you.
Hi, Dave.
Can you hear me?
Sort of. There's a lot of noise, but all right, we'll get
it's
through
better.
This. Yeah, better.
Is good?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
A pleasant good day to you.
Hello.
I was going to ask about fax in a moment, fax machine, but I was wondering if a JVC direct drive turntable has any chips in it.
A new one or an old one?
It's about 10 old. It's about 10 pounds.
Hey, Dave. Can you do me a favor? I don't know if you're running the turntable now, but can you turn it down just a little bit? Zach, the engineer,
sure.
Is giving me the
Stand
old
by.
Evil eye. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, Tony, so Giants aren't doing that good.
No, they're not.
Better?
That's better. Oh, yeah. Hello, Dave. You're back on.
Yes.
So go ahead. The question was about computer chips in a JVC turntable that's about 10 years old, you said.
Probably 30 years old.
Oh, 30 years old. I doubt it.
It's 10 pounds. It's a good 10 pounds, heavy.
Those are good machines. I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, depends. 30 years old, we'll put it back
died.
In the 80s or 90s.
What I did was I hadn't run it in about 2.5 years unless my cat turned it on for a few days. And I played it and it was working great, but I decided to fiddle with the pitch control just to kind of exercise it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then right away, Wow and Flutter went completely bonkers. Then the next time I plugged in about a month later, nothing, dead.
Oh, boy.
Except the tone arm goes up and down.
Is it a belt drive, my friend?
No, direct.
Okay. I think that one's out. Tony, you want to give it a shot?
You see this blank look on my face? It's nothing.
Dave, I would talk to you
I'll
about...
I'll bring it over to old Eldad. Eldad will take care of it.
I would talk to you about turntables all day, but I think that one is out of our league here on this computer show. But thank you. 800-348-2551 is our number. And let's see. Michelle and Troy. Michelle, you're on.
Hi. I have a consistent problem with printing, and I just heard somebody talk about printing. So I have a wireless printer in our house that works fine for Apple Print with my Apple devices, but if I print from an Apple device, then my IBM laptop won't print to the printer anymore.
Hmm.
Any ideas?
Yeah, you know, I can think a couple of things to try. One is get the latest firmware for the printer. A lot of times these printers, when they first release them, you know, they're made for the earliest versions of the operating system. So when new service packs come out and new updates come out, some of the coding changes. So you want to get the latest firmware to make sure that it's fully compatible with the OS.
And load the most recent driver?
Not just the driver, but the firmware. So the firmware is the read-only operating system that's on the printer itself. The driver is what sits on your computer that talks to the firmware on your printer so that they can print.
Well, what's the best way to find the updated firmware? A lot of people, on your smart TV, it'll say we're updating the firmware automatically if you're connected to the internet. But on something like a printer, you might have to go download that firmware and put it on. Is that an easy thing for most folks to do?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Ray. Most printers do not do auto firmware updates. It's a manual process.
Yeah.
However, most manufacturers have good instructions online. So it's a process of going to the manufacturer's website, such as HP or Epson, whatever you have. Type in the model number of your printer, and it will give you, most of the time, very, very clear instructions how to do the upgrade. It's often just running a piece of software, tell it where the firmware file is, and it does the update automatically that way.
Michelle.
Would I need to plug that in, like hardwired, to do that with the laptop rather than trying to do it wirelessly? Because if I plug in, it works, so...
Yeah, Michelle, that is a great question.
Yes,
because the reason why I'm saying that is when you're doing firmware updates. Now, driver updates is a whole other story. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing firmware updates, please use a hard wire, because as good as wireless have gotten over the years, it's still prone to interference. And when you're in the middle of doing a firmware update and there's a disruption, it could brick the device.
Okay. All right. Good. Now, this is a good question for those of us who have many a device that is not tethered to the main hub and we use Wi-Fi. What happens if you get halfway through an update like that and your power goes out or something happens?
Yeah.
Is there a way to recover the device?
That's hard to say for certain. Now, there are devices that will constantly check to see if you're done downloading the firmware before it does the update.
Yeah.
So those are probably better protected. And then there are other softwares that are not so sophisticated that would start doing the updates as it downloads the file.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're in the middle of erasing the old one, just at that perfect moment where the old one is getting erased and a new one hasn't been processed yet, now you're in big trouble. So use wired whenever you can, because there's nothing more reliable than a wire connection.
Michelle, one more follow-up if you need to.
Well, so I've looked up this printer numerous times. I don't recall seeing a new firmware. It's an older wireless printer that was manufactured by HP, who then sold the model to, I can't remember, Toshiba or something like that. So it's not, it used to be an HP. So I will try the firmware, but I don't recall seeing, I was hunting for all sorts of things on the manufacturer, but I find it obviously frustrating because I can print once, and then if I print from an Apple device, I can't print again to that printer.
Yeah, it sounds to me like that firmware isn't switching back and forth like it should. Once a job is done, it resets itself, and it's not doing that. Hmm. So, you know, try if you can't find the firmware, at the very least, get the most updated driver. Don't use the Windows built-in driver, but actually download the driver from the manufacturer, which has additional functionality and capability than the built-in drivers.
Michelle, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. By the way, just thought of this for no apparent reason. You know, we have this chip shortage. It's all, COVID-related and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Are you... All those machines that you take out of service, are you hoarding all the parts just in case?
No, unfortunately, they're not worth anything. We actually, in fact, have to pay somebody to take them away.
Okay, well, that gets to a question that Lexi wrote in. Lexi in Cheshire says, curious if you have a preferred place to send your old computer parts for selling for scrap.
I think that we deal mostly with ELOTs, which is, I'm going to say, I think it's in McKenneville somewhere.
Okay. But there are services. I'm sure there are more than one out there that will do this sort of thing. I think that some municipalities will also have days where you can drop off your electronics and they take care of it. I imagined it. I saw that recently.
They don't pay you anything. I know that in colonies, so I live in Latham, and when I go to the landfill, there's a whole section of the landfill that's designed for electronic drop-offs, including computers, printers, whatever you have.
Yeah, and they transfer it to another facility. The number here is 800-348-2551. Tony Yang joins us. Computers on the program today. Marv in Albany. Marv, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Ray, I'm your second biggest fan.
Who's the first biggest fan?
That you should know that.
Well, certainly not my children. Oh, maybe my wife. Okay, fair enough.
Join the club.
Yeah, go ahead, Marv.
Listen, now, without giving my age, I used to play a lot of Pong. So my question is this. Touch on security. The common user, I'm not a tech, like, completely lame. I've used it a lot in business. My son calls me a Luddite. But given a rudimentary understanding of it, what kind of security configuration, well, that's very specific, is just a user of a Mac, a Dell, whatever, and touch on the state of ransomware and why we can't combat that. So just kind of, it's not a specific question, but a framework for security for a common user, not a tech head, and where are we going with ransomware? And thanks for your time. And Ray, good luck.
Hey, man, thanks a lot, Mar. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Tony.
that's a good question, and I can just go on and on with this this topic. There's so many different ransomwares out there these days. Trying to get that under control, why is it so difficult? That's because software codes are always evolving. And you look at the Microsoft operating system, I think there's like 400 or 500 million lines of code in just one operating system. And you can find that within that framework, you only need a few lines or one line of code to exploit the operating system. So it's a very, very difficult process to keep it fully under control.
And is that one of the reasons that you will, as a company, wait a little while on the operating system before you bring it into a client? Or are you pretty much sure that the folks at whatever, Microsoft or whoever is making the systems, has a good handle on this stuff?
Yeah, we typically don't recommend brand new systems to be installed at client sites. In the older days, we wait until the first service pack.
Yeah.
But since Windows 10 and actually 7 was pretty good as well, it was stable to begin with.
Yep.
So now we change our strategy. We go, well, let's give it maybe 3 to 6 months. Let's not wait for the first service pack because it may not come out.
Yeah.
If it doesn't have any problems, they're not going to release the service pack. So now our strategy has changed a bit, but we do it because we want to make sure that it's stable. Microsoft has a small beta testing group comparing to the worldwide computer users. So we don't trust those numbers 100%. We would rather wait and just make sure that it's a stable system before we go ahead and recommend it to our clients. Just getting back to Marv's question here about the protection, because I think that's important for a lot of users. For most users, I would say 95 to maybe even close to 99% of the users out there, if you would just enable on a Windows platform, and a Mac is a little more tricky, but on the Windows platform, if you would just enable the Windows Microsoft Defense software and download something like a Malwarebytes, that generally will give you enough protection and enable the Windows firewall. Do not disable it.
But if you have a third-party firewall, you would not recommend also running the Windows, or would you?
No, it's one or the other, because now your system is running twice what it needs to run. That could drain on a resource and cause all kinds of transmission problems between the source and the host. So that's, you want to do one or the other.
In your opinion, and this is only your opinion, is it worth it in general to get a third-party firewall, or is the Windows firewall sufficient?
It is becoming a good piece of software. It wasn't. Now, if you pay for a third-party software like the Symantecs in the world, or Trend Micro,
Avast, or any of those,
Avast, they add additional services. besides just the basic protection. So the Microsoft software gives you a pretty decent frontline protection.
Yeah.
But you know, a Norton 365, as an example, 360 gives you much more than that. It's a broader protection that Microsoft won't offer. So it's I think it's worth the money. But if you don't, the basic Microsoft protection and the Microsoft firewall should give you enough for most users.
You know, if we could get a Norton 180, would it be half off?
Great question.
All right, we'll have to look into that one. Elizabeth in Shutesbury. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a Mac. I created a Google Doc. I saved it to my desktop. I emailed it to the other board members. They couldn't open it. They suggested I put it in Word. So I put it in Word, and now I'm getting the name of the document, .webarchive. And then it says it won't open it because it's from an unidentified developer and it cannot guarantee it's free from malware. I thought I had done it this way before, but I definitely need help step by step in order to be able to do this action, and I'm stuck.
Yeah. So Google has this open source Office software that you can run on a Mac, or you can, you know, it's platform independent, so you can run it almost anything. The string that's attached to that is the other user has to be using the Google software as well. When you try exporting files, they tend to work okay, but then you run into these problems like this, where somebody can't open it, or you know, some type of a export code is just not being read by Microsoft Word correctly. So I will suggest that if you're going to stay with the Google Docs, have your other users use the same platform. Have them log into to Google and create an account on there.
You know, that's really helpful, except that I know for a fact that one of the other board members uses Google Docs, and nobody was able to open it. So maybe I should recreate the document?
So the one thing you might want to consider is not download it and sending it. Leave it on Google Drive and share it out. That way you can
share it out.
Yeah, you know, that's what it's designed for. It's Google systems were never designed to be an offline system. It was always meant to be this online storage system.
That's why schools use them and such.
That's right. Ah. Because now you can go anywhere, be on anything, and you can use it as long as you got internet access.
Yeah.
Okay, now I have to learn how to do share, which I don't know, but I'll figure it out.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. And let's see. Sheila writes, for those of us who do not know, Tony, can you please carefully explain what exactly a VPN is? Is a VPN something everybody should have? If so, how do you go about getting one, especially if your device is already compromised?
I think two different subjects here.
Yeah.
On the VPN part, so VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. The invention of that was meant for corporate remote users to log in to their company's network.
Yeah.
And establish this private tunnel so that it's as if you were sitting at the corporate office using your computer. So all the things that you may send out or send in goes through your corporate network and not to your computer directly. So that was the idea behind VPNs to begin with.
Yeah.
And then nowadays, most people use it because they're trying to either hide their identity when they're on the internet. And lots of people these days with all of this, you know, cryptocurrency craze, people use it because U.S. has restrictions on what you can trade and not trade.
Ah.
So if your IP is part of the U.S. IP base, you can't buy or sell some of these cryptocurrencies. So what you do is you buy a VPN service that has a server in, let's say, you know, South America somewhere, and do your trade that way.
Ah.
So nowadays it's mostly used for two functions, right? To not have people know where you're coming from. Get away around restrictions that we have.
I see. So, in other words, if you're just an average Sheila, let's say, you may not need it.
It really doesn't have much of a purpose. I don't I don't use a VPN unless I got to go into my office to do something. Other than that, no, I don't use a VPN.
Tony Yang is our guest today. It's computers. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll get back to your calls and more from the email bag in a moment. Jeff back for you here as our bumper music. It's Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. A couple of emails about David's turntable down in Woodstock. Two different people said, hey, make sure you clean the pots on that thing. Get a little deoxit, clean it out. It might be happy as can be. So, yeah, it's not really a computer-related thing, but, David, you can give that a shot. We'll see what happens. Let's go to Jeff in Gilderland. Jeff, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Ray. Thanks, Tony.
Hey,
Jeff. I've got about 8 laptops that are all – they've all been dropped. They don't work. They've been replaced. I just want to know, what is a secure way and an ecological way to get rid of these things?
Good question.
So, Jeff, if you take it to a place like Elot, you can actually pay him to wipe out, security wipe out the data that's on those laptops.
So you already bought a new computer and you have this old one and then you have to pay again. Come on.
If you want it to be completely security wiped out, that's the best
way. Couldn't you just take an axe to it and then bring it to the, a transfer station?
Well, there's things like neodymium magnets in some of these things.
Yeah.
And there's got to be a recyclable way to, turn them back in.
Yeah. So, we were just talking about the colony.
Yeah, the transfer
landfill.
Station. They have them in every town pretty much.
Yep. So they have these special areas set up for electronics. And the reason why they do that is their plan is to recycle these things so that it doesn't become a
But how do you wipe
hazard.
It, though, fully if you're on your own?
If you're on your own to wipe it fully, there are software out there that you can run, which will wipe the drives out at the bit level.
So in other words, reformatting doesn't get rid of everything?
It doesn't.
Interesting.
Especially if you're doing
that. What if I took the computer case off and took a real strong magnet and ran it over the hard drive?
Yeah, that does work. It's not 100% guarantee that'll be it, but that does work. You know, the other thing you can do is you can take the screws if you take the screws off the drive casing and get to the actual data platter itself, and you scratch that with a pin or something, it will be almost impossible to get data off it. So that's a fairly easy, it's doable by somebody at home with a screwdriver.
And I know, Jeff, that where I live, you can go to the transfer station. It does cost you for things like air conditioners or computers or whatever, but you put it in a spot, and then it will be taken away, and they will do it in a way that doesn't throw magnets into the environment.
Well, that's good. And I want the magnets to be reused. They're rare metals.
Yeah. Save them.
You know?
Put them on your fridge.
Yeah.
You know?
I've got a stainless steel fridge, Ray.
Okay. Oh, good for you, man. Wow, you're living large. Hey, Jeff, thanks for the call. Let's go to Lynn in Schenectady. Lynn, you're on.
Okay, I have a Mac desktop, and I want to take the movie that's on my Mac and watch it on my smart TV, and I've been told all I need is an HDMI cable, but the directions all speak of PCs, no Macs. Is it the same?
Yes, HDMI is a platform-independent device, so you can get a HDMI cable and plug it into any... You know, whether it's Mac or PC, it doesn't matter. It's independent of the base operating system.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lynn. No, that was an easy one.
Yeah, that was an easy one.
800-348-2551. Tony Yang is with us today. And this is from Norm. from Ray's third biggest fan, Norman Albany. All right, well, there you go. What is the difference between anti-malware software and antivirus software? Do I need both?
So that, you know, that's a great question because there used to be a lot of distinction between these two. Nowadays, it's almost merging. Like that line is getting, you know, it's blurry now because they're almost essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
Most viruses these days are malware viruses. In the earlier days, malwares were these little, you know, bits and pieces of software that collects data on your computer.
Like
and
cookies, sends it. Only a little advanced. Like,
right, exactly. It wasn't always harmful.
Right.
Right. But nowadays, you get it, and it could cause all kinds of craziness. Yep. So that line now is getting very, very blurry. But in old days, that's the difference. Viruses were going to come in and destroy everything on your computer. Malware was just there to steal information. These days, it's a blurry line.
Aside from government entities, where you can see to get an advantage over an adversary, you'd want to tunnel in or put a virus on. What sort of a mental makeup of just the average person would it be to throw a virus out there just to create havoc? Why, Tom?
Yeah, I know. You think these guys will have something better to do? I think there is a community on the internet of these extremely talented software coders out there, and this is a way to establish your reputation. The stronger the antivirus software, the malware that you write, the better your reputation is. And you know, there is that cult out there of these super, what they call super hackers, and then to get into that realm, you need to have a reputation.
But if they're that smart, couldn't they just go and apply at some of these big computer entities and make a fortune?
Right.
I mean, with benefits and retirement.
Absolutely. You know, they could be the next Bill Gates, but they choose to do this other thing.
Yeah.
But I tell you, some of these people are really amazing. They're able to look through these hundreds of millions of lines of code and detect that one that they can exploit.
And how many do you have on your staff? All right. We'll table that question. Let's go to Michael in Clifton Park. Michael, you're on.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have a interesting problem. Every time I open a folder on my computer, which has Windows 10, I get this pop-up that says that put in the last segment of a full volume zip file, something to that effect. I'm not at home now, so I don't remember exactly what it says. The only thing I have connected to the computer is a USB Seagate, like a storage file or a backup file. Like those little books that holds so many gigabytes or whatever, or terabytes. That's all I have hooked to the computer. I don't have any idea what it's talking about as far as a full-volume zip file and what to do about it, how to get rid of it.
Well, you know, I haven't heard of anything like that for a while. So the way that the zip files work is if you want to send, say, 100 files to somebody, instead of sending and attaching 100 files, you zip them all up into this one single .zip or .raw file and send it to the person across the world, wherever it goes. And then that person has to get the same type of software to unzip it so that they can get into the contents of those 100 files that you're sending.
Mm.
The problem comes when you know you have the option of zipping it all up onto this one file, or you can zip it all up into multiple different files. So imagine you're sending a huge amount of data.
Yeah.
You don't want to put them all on the one, like a single terabyte file. You want to spread that out.
Yeah.
And I think what you're experiencing is that because they're spread out through these many different parts, with many different parts to make up this one file, there's a part of it that's missing.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot with these PAR2 files where, you know, if you download... I'm not sure if I should be talking about
all right,
this.
Well, be careful.
If there are people out there that put these contents on the internet, and the files are so big, they're like a Blu-ray movie.
Okay,
right?
So you're talking about pirating of films, Tony.
This is
that what you're
mostly,
talking about?
It's mostly commonly used for that, unfortunately.
All right, fine.
So if you know, you get a 50-gig file, and it's spread into 50 different files, you have to download all 50 of them. And if you're missing one of those files, it won't be able to construct the original file that you need to play to play the software.
Yeah.
So I think that's where your issue is. There is a missing part, and unfortunately, it's very, very hard to tell, what happened there.
Michael.
I have a program that every time I close it, it backs up anything that I'd had open or any changes that I've made into a separate folder, and it's a zip file. And you can't open it with anything but with that program if you need that backup.
Okay.
But you're saying maybe I need to delete all of those files and then do another backup or something like that?
Yeah, I will recommend, Michael, that you don't back up all of your files into one zip file. I think as a backup, because that's your safeguard for the
data.
That's
everything, yeah.
I'm uneasy personally about backing everything up into one single file, because if any bit of data in that zip file is missing, it's almost impossible to recover all the files within it. So I will eliminate the use of a zip file as a backup solution.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. Tony Yang joins us today. Computers on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This email from Kathy. And Kathy says, PC hubs will not work. I have a one-year-old PC laptop with one USB port. When I plug in a multi-use hub, like one with multi-USB ports, the mouse or keyboard, etc., plugged into these hub ports will work for about 20 seconds. Then the PC makes that annoying rejection sound, and the mouse, etc., stops working. Any idea what's going on?
That actually happens more often than
yes,
they should.
It does.
I would definitely recommend that you get a high quality, more of a brand name USB hub
out
there.
It's a hardware issue.
It's a hardware issue. There's also versions of USB out there now, right? There's that USB.
C.
There's A and B and C.
Yeah.
Ideally, they should be compatible with each other.
Right.
Especially backwards compatible. But it doesn't always work that way. Some of the higher quality hubs tend to be more compatible, but it's not always the case. So first thing I would do that I would recommend you checking is to make sure that they're on the same USB version number.
Okay.
That will get it to work better. And if that doesn't work, then perhaps try a different brand.
Okay.
Because, devices are like anything else out there. There's the cheap version.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? Average version, and then the better versions. And the reason why they charge more money is because they did more research and make sure that it's more compatible with the general devices out there.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Tony Yang joins us today. Computers on Vox Pop. And another Tony, who's in Glens Falls, is on the line. Tony.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I broke out an old iMac because I've been doing some Zoom meetings, and it's been difficult to do on my phone. So I thought it'd be nice to do it on a large screen. And powering it up, it powered up great, and went to go download the Zoom app and realized I don't have the App Store application on my computer. And when I went to go download it, it basically wouldn't let me. It kept saying Safari can't find the server. And it doesn't let me get to other sites as well, like Yahoo Mail. I'm just wondering if you have any idea what's going on with that.
Huh. Yeah, it sounds more like you got an internet connectivity problem than anything else. The one thing you might want to check is to make sure that your computer doesn't have – a lot of times when you can't get to these sites, it's because it's a thing called DNS. DNS is this name translation program that you got to have. It translates all names like Yahoo to an IP address. And when you can't get to anywhere, mm-hmm. typically it's a problem with either the IP address or DNS. So you're dealing more, I think, with a network issue than an actual software issue, because you can't get to any sites at all. That shouldn't have anything to do with the App Store.
Other Tony, Glens Falls.
Okay. 113 device. Just curious, if I were to wipe the computer clean, would that help at all?
That would help, because what that does is it resets all of your IP settings back to default, which means it will just pick up an IP address and pick up a DNS server address from your router, which the reason, you know, the reason we know a lot about this is because we serve these larger schools with tens of thousands of devices.
Yeah.
And some kid will get creative and put a static DNS IP address on their computer, and it won't work because we don't allow it.
Ah. All right, Tony, thank you very much for the call. Our number here in the waning moments is 800-348-2551. It's actually the same number at the beginning of the show, but if you want to call, we have a couple minutes left. 800-348-2551. Tony, we were on a conversation earlier about wiping computers clean. And Joe Makowitz, who's stepping in today screening calls, said, oh, yeah, you could take an axe to the hard drive, but it doesn't work with solid state. How do you wipe? How do you be sure that you wipe a solid state drive?
Well, a solid state drive is a device within it, within the casing as well. So if you smash that up, it's pretty hard to get any data out of it.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, Joe is giving us the high sign there.
Yeah,
I think that was a thumb.
So you know, axe just works well with everything.
Well, do you guys use that over at Gig at all?
No. Sometimes we feel like we want to use axe.
Now, you've been in this game a long time. You were talking about DNS, and I remember in the 90s. So the earliest days I remember, my brother had computers in the early 80s, but they weren't on the internet, you know.
Yeah.
DNS was a problem a lot. You don't see it that much anymore.
You know, DNS was really not a widespread thing that people knew about. Internet in the early days, you know, maybe you don't even go back this far, but when I was in high school and college, we had the early version of the internet.
Right.
It was mostly hypertext. Remember Gopher, the text-based search engine? Those were the days when DNS started to become more prominent. Now, you know, it is a standard part of internet. Without
who
DNS,
decides
nothing
that
works.
Standard? In other words, in order for it to work, everyone's got to agree on it. How did that happen?
So, great question, actually, because this is, you know, brain. This is knowledge in the deep part of my brain here that I almost never use. So, DNS, there is a committee organization that has the root servers. They maintain it. Everybody else who run DNS servers have to go and sync their server up with the root servers. So if you don't do that, you're out of the loop and you won't get to places that you need to get
to. So let me guess. Let's just cut to the chase. The NSA owns the whole thing, right? It's probably in West Virginia or some. Am I wrong or is that just paranoia?
No, you are right. Government owned it in the beginning.
Yeah.
Remember, this was all a Defense Department project in the beginning. The government owned it, and now it is owned by a quote-unquote private company that has control of the entire internet in the world.
That's a pretty good gig.
It is. You know, monopoly. There's nothing like it.
All right, let's go get one more in here at least before the end here with Tony Yang. Elaine in Lenox. Elaine, you're on.
Hi, great. Thanks for taking my call. So I am not very knowledgeable about computers, and I have a little MacBook Air. That's 2012, and I am trying to take things off of it to make room for it because my computer guy says it's too full. So how do I use external hard drives so I can move my home photos and videos over onto the hard drive so it looks kind of like my computer? Wow. And how many hard drives do I need to have because I don't want to pay $10 a month to have an iCloud through Apple or someplace else?
Okay. We only have about 25 seconds, Tony.
Okay. So you can pick up a 4 terabyte or bigger USB drive from, let's say, Best Buy or Staples. Most of them are compatible with the Mac. Just make sure it's compatible with the Mac. You plug into your USB drive, and it will appear as another drive. And then you can simply drag and drop to the USB drive and clear out the space on your system.
All right, Elaine, good luck with that. We appreciate the call, and we appreciate everybody's call today. Tony Yang, thanks for being here, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. That was fun.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from People USA, a regional nonprofit working to deliver care alternatives created by people who have personally overcome mental health or addiction challenges. People-USA.org. At Chester Common Table, Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts, locally sourced comfort food, wine, and cocktails, offering socially distant dining indoors and out, Thursday through Sunday from 4 to 9 p.m., ChesterCommonTable.com. Once again, thanks to Tony Yang of Gig Computers for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Joe Makowitz, who filled in screening the calls today. Tomorrow on a program, it's gardening. And you know how much fun it is to dig in the dirt, so get a shovel and join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. The gardeners will be here. I'm Ray Graff. Stand by now for 51%.